So does that mean somebody has to be talking at all times so that the hiss doesn't arrive?
Well, that's not the worst. That's quite easy to take out. Okay. Actually, okay. That's not too bad.
But if I hiss in the background?
It's easy because it's constant. So if you really want to mess things up, change the pitch of your hiss as we go.
And welcome to a wonderful episode of Somewhere in Between, the AIT and First Five Early Careers podcast brought to you by the RCGP. My name's Mira, and I'm actually not really involved in this episode, but have been hounded by my colleagues to do the intro and outro. So you're welcome to my dulcet tones for another couple of seconds. Earlier this week, my colleagues Hatim, Johannes and Kim were speaking to our new RCGP chair, Camilla Hawthorne, a bit about her career in primary care, what this role will mean to her, and sort of the vision of GP going forward. So sit back, relax and enjoy.
Professor Camilla Hawthorne, thank you so much for joining us on our podcast. I think the first thing that we all want to hear is a little bit about your career story. What was your journey into general practice, and what have been the highs and lows of the last years of your career so far?
Thank you. First of all, thank you for inviting me onto this podcast. So let me tell you a little bit about what I'm doing now, and then I'll tell you how I got there. So I'm currently, I feel in my core, I'm a GP. I'm an everyday frontline GP. And my clinical practice is in a small ex-mining town called Mountain Ash in the Welsh Valleys, halfway between Cardiff and Merthyr. And you take a left towards Aberdare, and Mountain Ash is on the way, and it's very beautiful around there. But I'm also currently head of graduate entry medicine at Swansea University. And over the years, have been developing a career, I suppose, in medical education, which perhaps surprisingly melds really well with general practice and general practice principles, you know, about generalism. It does mean that as a GP, there's not much in medicine that scares me too much. You know, okay, so there may be something about neurology. That's fine. I can deal with that. Some gynae. Yep, I can deal with that. Bit of peds, no problem. And it does mean that my job as head of graduate entry medicine is really quite, it's lovely, it's exciting, it's creative, and it uses my general practice skills, including my communication skills, quite a bit. So how did I get here? Well, I qualified as a GP back in 1988. That's when I did my MRC GP. I had done my GP training in Nottingham. And I, as many people do, became a partner in the practice where I had been a trainee. In fact, I'd chosen that practice quite carefully because I wanted to work there. It had a very good reputation and it had some really nice people working there, and I thought I'd be happy there. And sure enough, I was. But it only lasted 18 months, rather sadly, because I was following a hospital husband who was working his way up the gastroenterology career ladder. So Barney found a job then as a senior registrar, as was in those days, in Manchester. So after 18 months in this lovely dream practice, I moved to Manchester. And so that was in 1991. Then I thought to myself, okay, I want to do something different. I've been working as a GP in the leafy suburbs, which is very nice, but I wanted to try something different. So I applied for a practice in city centre Manchester in Fallowfield. And I knew it would be very different. I knew it would be perhaps more challenging, but wanted to try it and see what I made of it. I was pretty sure we might move on again because we didn't know where his consultant's post would be. So it might only be a temporary stopgap. As it turned out, it was 3 years in Fallowfield, and it was challenging, but oh boy, did I learn a lot about how to deal with people, how to deal with difficult people, as well as how to deal with people who themselves were really challenged by life and what life was throwing at them. And that, in a way, changed my whole approach to general practice. So when we moved 3 years later, it was now early 1995, with two small children under the age of five in tow, we moved down to Cardiff for my husband's consultant job. By the way, I told him at that point, if you go anywhere else, you're going on your own next time. But anyway, turned up in Cardiff with these two small children and went again for a city centre practice because I decided that actually working with deprived communities was what I wanted to do. Again, I was in that practice for about 15 years, initially working part-time, teaching medical students in practice. And as time goes by, you find yourself managing the other GP tutors in Cardiff who are teaching students in their practice. And then I started getting more and more into the medical school in Cardiff, ended up as the deputy lead for year three. Along the way, I'd become an MRC GP examiner and so developed an expertise in assessment. Again, if anybody had said to me when I left medical school that I'd find assessment interesting or exciting, I think I'd have laughed at them. But it is, actually. It's surprisingly interesting and it's at times very exciting, as I'm sure you would probably appreciate as well. And so that assessment expertise helped in my academic progression in Cardiff, and I became the assessment lead for the medical school in Cardiff. That was around about 2010. And then from that, associate dean for governance and quality at the medical school. And then in 2015, and all the same time, I was still being a GP part-time. And then in 2015, I was invited by the University of Surrey to go to Guildford to help them set up a new medical school. And essentially what they said to me is, you can have a blank sheet of paper and you can design a medical school for us. And that was just such an invitation. I love that sort of thing, starting from scratch. I love blue skies thinking. I like being able to think outside the box. Having by then been a GP for about 20 years, I felt that I had a lot of things that I wanted to put into an undergraduate curriculum. You know, things that had taken me 20 years to learn. I thought, I'm sure that students would find it very much more useful to learn some of these things quicker. So off I went to Guildford for 3 years. And at that time, I don't know if you remember, but Jeremy Hunt was talking about additional medical school places. And we waited and we waited and we waited. Really frustrating times because Brexit then happened and that delayed any decision on medical school places. And then suddenly the 1,500 places were announced. Some of them were allocated to existing medical schools immediately, but there was a fair number that were left. And then there was a 6-week scramble to write a bid. So we wrote the bid and sent it in and waited. Now, all the time, we'd been getting lots of hints that it wasn't a question of whether or not we'd get a medical school. It was how many places would we get? So it came as a really awful shock to realise that we weren't going to get any places at all. And the only feedback we got was that the people who were making these decisions had decided that they were going to allocate these places to under-doctored areas, and they felt Surrey wasn't under-doctored enough. So that was a real disappointment. That was in 2018. So I closed things down in Surrey and came back to South Wales because my home was still in Cardiff. Picked up more of my general practice because I was somehow managing to be a GP all the way through this and took on more sessions and did more sessions, moved up to Mountain Ash. And then a year later, the job came up in Swansea. So in fact, I found myself doing in Swansea what I had been wanting to do in Surrey, but I'm doing it in Swansea and it's close enough to my home in Cardiff to be able to get back to my own bed at night to sleep and see my family. And so it's funny how things turn out, isn't it? So that's been my career journey. But I've done lots of other things along the way as well. My research interest was in ethnic minority health inequalities, particularly in the context of South Asian populations and type 2 diabetes. And that was an interest I developed in Nottingham as a trainee and managed to get some research funding in Nottingham, which I then took with me to Manchester and ended up doing an MD on culturally appropriate health education and whether it worked, whether it makes a difference or not, which it does. And then when I came to Cardiff, we then started implementing it as service delivery rather than just research, because it seems terribly unfair to be researching all these communities all the time and not giving back something of what you've learned. So I suppose that in a nutshell is me and my story.
I mean, well, firstly, what a fascinating career journey. And the thread throughout all of that was the fact that despite being pulled in so many different places, the core was the time, you know, you had that time working as a GP. And I've always found that it's really beneficial when you are doing these other things, it actually makes you a better practitioner. And you mentioned that, you know, with education, nothing really scares you anymore because you're doing the education side of things, but then you're also practicing as a GP.
Yeah.
How would you encourage the next generation, or, you know, when this is an early career GP podcast, to think about how they create, you know, that pathway for themselves, that they are able to explore other interests, but always keep that core in general practice?
I think you need to have confidence in yourself. I many times didn't. Many times thought, I'm not going to get this, or it's not going to work, or things would go wrong, or you'd come across a barrier to what you wanted to do. But I think, you know, for early career GPs nowadays, and actually my daughter is one, she's a first five GP in Chepstow. I think it's important to have something that really fires you up. That's what did it for me, was having a project on the side, if you like, which in my case was the research that I was doing first in Nottingham, then in Manchester. And then it sort of grows, you know, you take one step, it's little steps, isn't it? One step at a time, and things sort of grow from it. You need to be able to think clearly. You need to be able to compartmentalize your time. That's what's helped me, is that, you know, when I'm in general practice, I don't really let anything else bother me. You know, university may wish to call me, but they won't get me to answer them because I'm talking to patients and I'm concentrating on the patients. And for me, patients should always come first. And in fact, you know, when things went belly up in Surrey in 2018 and we didn't get any places, at first I was devastated. As you could imagine, I'd been working for 3 years. I'd written a curriculum from scratch. We'd even started employing people because we were so sure it was going to happen. And at first I thought it was just dreadful, an absolute catastrophe. And then I thought to myself, hang on a minute, you haven't killed anybody. You haven't hurt or damaged anybody. You haven't lied. You haven't cheated. This is stuff, and stuff happens. Just get on with it. And actually that helped me hugely, as this whole ethos of being a GP, being there for your patients and putting your patients first, meant that I could deal with other things rather better perhaps than I might have done.
I'm going to do the thing that a GP should never do and ask you two questions at the same time. My first question is going back to this idea that you love blue skies thinking and having the blank canvas. So having kind of not had the opportunity to see what became of your plans for this new curriculum in this new medical school, what were the kind of things that you wanted to do with that blank canvas, and what were the things that you wanted to implement or change that you felt would be really impactful and meaningful? Yeah. And have you managed to do any of that at Swansea?
Yes, guess what? Yes, I came with lots of things in my back pocket when I came to Swansea, and quite a lot of them I've managed to implement, which I'm really pleased about. So what I learned in Surrey had a new vet school at the time, not so new now. And one of the things that we talked about, me and the vets, was this concept of One Health. And if COVID has taught us anything, it is the importance of animal husbandry and animal health, as well as of ecology and environment and climate change on human health. And I wanted to bring in a One Health vertical theme into this wonderful curriculum I was going to write for Surrey. I wanted students to be much more grounded in the communities around the medical school. It seemed to me, certainly from my Cardiff days, that students would come to Cardiff, they would do a perfectly good medical course and come out as perfectly competent doctors, but with very little idea of what was actually going on in Cardiff or in the surrounding areas. And I discovered that actually when with a group of year three students, we used to do special study module, an SSC in medicine and literature in year three. And because we are Wales and we were close to Hay on Wye, we would take them up to the literature festival in May. And one of my colleagues, another GP, had hired a minibus and he was driving. And I was in there with a couple of others, and we had a group of about 10 medical students, and we were going up the A470 to Hay, and we passed Merthyr. Now, we go up the A470, everybody's chatting, we go past Merthyr, and the conversation stops, and they look out of the window, and they say, what's that? And because, of course, Merthyr is very deprived, it's, you know, almost a black hole, really, of deprivation in many ways, with really poor morbidity, mortality figures, and all deprivation related. And we said, oh, that's Merthyr. Don't you know about Merthyr? And they said, no. And the driver was born and bred in South Wales, and he knew a lot about the history of Merthyr, about the rise of the coal fields and the steel industry. Merthyr was the first place where anybody marched with the red flag, and the Merthyr riots, they started the trade union movement. And then, of course, later on, the use of the Tredegar Miners Panel by Aneurin Bevan in setting up the NHS. And I watched the students' faces and I thought, we're missing a trick here. There's just so much going on in our backyard that we're not telling them about. They don't really have any idea as to why it is that deprivation is now high in the Welsh Valleys, whereas in fact it's really low in the Vale of Glamorgan, only about 15, 20 miles away. And why is it? What's happened? You know, of course, with the death of the steel industry and the mining, people are still there, but there are no jobs, or you have to go much further afield to get those jobs. And so I was really anxious for our new students, I hoped, in Surrey, to get involved in community projects and to learn about service and service to communities as well as to individual patients. So that was another thing that I was very keen on bringing in. And then Surrey is an engineering university. See, I learned a lot from going to Surrey, despite the fact it ended in failure. It actually taught me a huge amount. So Surrey is an engineering university, and they have a big training and research area, which they called an engineering for health. And the engineers there would say to me, because there weren't many medics on the campus, so they had to talk to me if they wanted to talk to a medic, so there weren't many others. And they said to me, we can build you anything that you want, but we need to know what you want. So we need doctors who understand what they need and have got some, they don't need to go home and write software all night or coding mechanisms, but they need to know what sort of things they want, and then we can build them for you. They were working with companies like McLaren, the racing car people, who had factories nearby. And on their racing cars, apparently, they have all sorts of gadgets and gizmos that measure tilt and speed and wind speed and all this kind of thing. And they were adapting those gizmos for people to measure gait and to look at how people walk and how people move. And they had realized that everybody's got their own fingerprint of gait, if you like. And particularly with the aging population, you can tell when somebody's gait is changing before they actually fall and break their hip or their wrist or their head or whatever. You know, and of course, the whole idea there is that if you can do that, you can actually get in there and stop it from happening. All sorts of, you know, brilliant ideas that make you think about the future of medicine, and where it may be going. The other thing that they do was looking at big data. With big data, again, you can identify people who are at risk of emergency admission. And if you've got the right teams that are agile and mobile, you can get out there again to intervene and try and stop people from needing an emergency hospital admission. So all of that was happening in Surrey as part of their research. And I was really keen to try and incorporate it into an undergraduate medical curriculum. Obviously, you have to fit in all the medicine as well. But some of this is about preparing the next generation of doctors for the world that they're going to be in.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting and important to think about how medical school trains us very much to kind of deal with an individual body, but doesn't really think about how that body interacts with the community, but also how medicine interacts with fields like engineering, because we don't really have exposure to those other fields, which we're so kind of, we rely on them so much, but we just don't have any kind of interface with them. You also mentioned earlier this concept of culturally appropriate health education. You said it was something that was successful. Could you clarify a little bit about what exactly that means and how that manifests itself in a curriculum?
Okay. I became interested, as I said, when I was a GPST. So I was in my third year of training. And in those days, we used to have a half day. It wasn't a half day training day, we had a half day. I thought to myself, I don't really understand enough about diabetes. And so my way of dealing with that was to go along to the local hospital, speak to one of the diabetologists and apply for a clinical assistance post in a diabetic clinic. So I used to do a diabetic clinic in the hospital once a week as a clinical assistant. I'm not sure if you're allowed to do that nowadays as a trainee, you probably aren't. Anyway, one day I was sitting in my room with patients in the clinic in the hospital. This is at the Queen's Medical Centre in Nottingham. And I heard the registrar in the room next to me shouting at his patient. His patient was a South Asian lady who didn't speak English. And I think his way of making himself understood was just to talk louder, which, of course, doesn't work. And so I remember sort of wincing when I heard that. And then when I went out to pick up the next set of notes for my next patient, it was an abnormally thick set of notes with an Asian person's name on it. And I remember thinking, oh my goodness, you know, this is going to be a difficult consultation. And then I thought to myself, you should be ashamed of yourself. You know, you really ought to be trying to do more for this person. Clearly they need more, their baseline is different. And that sort of sparked the interest, because that was in the late 1980s. When we were just realizing that type 2 diabetes was six times commoner in British South Asians compared to white people in Britain. We didn't know the reasons why. I'm not sure that we still do even now completely know the reasons why. But we were suddenly starting to realize that it was a really big public health problem. So my first little project was to pick 50 people with type 2 diabetes from the South Asian background and match them with 50 white people for age and sex, and then contact them and go and talk to them about diabetes to find out what they knew about diabetes. And what I discovered was that South Asian people knew much less about diabetes than white people. And you might see, and if that's in the late 1980s, I think it's still the same now, sadly. But anyway, that's what I found. However, both groups had been offered the same education, the same educational opportunities. And I don't know if you've seen that cartoon picture of equality and equity, of people standing, you know, three people in a row standing on a little box trying to look over a fence. And I realized that that box was just the same size for everybody. And if you happen to be short, you never got to look over the fence. Whereas if you happen to be tall, you could look over. Do you know the one I'm talking about? You've probably seen it. And so I thought, okay, now what? Now what do we do? And then I remembered something that I had learned as a medical student, actually. In my first year as a medical student, my first summer holidays, I had won a travel scholarship from school and I got another one from my university. So I combined the two because neither was actually worth very much. And with it, I went to visit a community project in the centre of India, in Maharashtra. And there I had seen village health workers who were local people who were trained to go around talking to mothers of children under five. And this was all about trying to prevent mortality in under fives, particularly from diarrhea. And so they would talk to them about rehydration and homemade rehydration methods, about nutrition and, you know, sort of general health care for under fives. And I'd gone out with one of these village health workers for several days and watched them doing it. And they used pictures to explain what it was they were trying to teach. And I thought to myself, I wonder if we could do something like that in this country. You know, why not? Because I realized that a lot of my patients that I was interested in didn't speak English. Many couldn't read or write in any language. And I don't speak other Indian languages. I grew up in East Africa, so I can speak Swahili and I can understand some Indian languages, but I can't speak them. So that was the idea, that was the spark. And I then designed a randomized controlled trial. That's what I did in Manchester when he moved to Manchester, using a local person from one of the communities who actually had a background in teaching to go out and provide this culturally appropriate health education using some pictorial flashcards. And we actually looked to see if it actually improved HbA1c's, did it improve blood pressures, did it improve cholesterols, etc. And we did it for 200 people. So there were 100 in the intervention group and 100 in the control group. And we then had a look at their indices 6 months later. And so the people in the control group got the education at the end of the 6 months, whereas obviously the people in the intervention group got it at the beginning. And what we found was that there was definitely a trend in improvement in HbA1c's in the intervention group as a whole. But if you actually then looked at the women in that group, they had significantly poorer HbA1c's before we started, and they significantly improved by 6 months. Nothing else much improved, but I think that was because 6 months probably isn't long enough, to be able to tell that much of a difference. But certainly, you know, confidence improved and interest improved. And, you know, some of these flashcards, they were all pictures, there were no words at all. And I remember there was one flashcard which had a picture of all the foods that you could eat with a South Asian diet, if you like, against a sort of saffron background. So it really looked appetizing. I created it with the help of a dietitian. And people would look at this card, they'd pore over it, they'd look at all the individual foods, and they'd sometimes say to me, can I have this card to put on my fridge? And you suddenly realise that it was going to become their shopping list. It was just really interesting how people reacted to the pictures and how they found them. So I had another one, which was just of an Asian man and he had the diabetic complications superimposed on his body in red so that you could talk about them. It wasn't me that was talking, it was the community worker who was talking. And I remember watching one patient look at this card, and then he looked at me and he said rather sadly, I've got all of these things. You know, and it's just, you know, really touching, really, really touching. As you can tell, I thoroughly enjoy doing this project. And then when I moved to Cardiff, we adapted it for the Bangladeshi community in Cardiff and worked with one GP practice to start with. And then once we'd gone through all their Bangladeshi patients, we then moved to surrounding practices. So this is in the late 1990s, early 2000s. And then from that, I got more funding from the Welsh Assembly. And we started working with many more communities, not just Bangladeshi. So we worked with Pakistanis, Gujaratis, Sikhs, Chinese, African Caribbeans, and those were the main groups. And you know, at weekends we'd go to community centres, we'd go to churches, we'd go to temples. It was really interesting actually, and use those flashcards. Again, using the method, this time as service delivery, not as research. So I suppose that was my sort of project on the side. What it did I put it into this new curriculum? Only sort of peripherally, not as a sort of major theme, but again, it was part of my learning, of the feedback you get and the satisfaction you get of working with communities rather than just concentrating on one person in your consulting room. You know, getting outside those walls and getting out there. And what I learned, for example, was that you get much more buy-in from a community if you can link in with something that community is already doing. If you link in with a festival, if you link in with a special day or some event that they're already arranging, and with their invitation, of course, you turn up with all your stuff. You can talk about exercise. You can even do some exercises, do some dancing. Weigh and measure people, do their blood pressures, do their BMIs, talk about cholesterol, talk about blood sugars, talk about diet, talk about healthy lifestyles. And it works much, much better than trying to do what I call a parachute jump, and actually set it up all yourself. much better if you do it in partnership with the community, and much more fun.
Yeah, I think obviously sometimes when we hear from people like you've had these incredible careers and done all of these things, it can sound quite overwhelming, and you wonder how can I make change like that. But I think that last thing you said is a really good tip for how, you know, as a GP with a busy day to day, you can make a meaningful intervention for communities just by finding the days that are important to them and to the community locally, and attach some health interventions to that.
Yes. And, you know, if somebody had told me back in 1988 what I'd be doing in 2006, I don't think I'd have believed them. I think it's what happens is that just day by day, you're just doing what you think is the right thing to do. You're just enjoying it. It almost becomes a hobby. A lot of it was unpaid. And I was lucky because my husband is earning. So, you know, I was very lucky. I appreciate that. But it did mean that I wasn't just having to follow him around, and make do every time we turned up in a new place.
I was just going to follow on from sort of the talk about and the focus on health inequality, because obviously that's very, there's a huge focus on health inequality now, but you were sort of focusing on it before it was, I don't want to be insulted, but it's before it was trendy, you were sort of focusing on it. And now it's very, very in vogue, and it's all about health inequality. Do you think we've got better at managing or focusing on health inequalities in terms of how we manage patients? Or do you think we've perhaps just lifted the lid on it a little bit more and kind of at least kind of acknowledged that it's an issue?
I think we have become more aware. I'm not sure that we've got better. I think the health inequalities are getting wider. And I think one of the reasons they're getting wider is that social inequalities are getting wider. And it worries me that this government does not seem to put the two things together. I'm sure it knows they're not stupid in government. I'm sure it realises that. Maybe it's too big a job for them to do. But I really feel that all this stuff that Boris Johnson was going on about levelling up, we're not going to level up in health inequalities until we level up in social inequalities. And there's such good evidence that that is the root cause of a lot of health inequalities. I've completely bought into Michael Marmot's way of thinking about adverse childhood events. Very often, I'm sure all of you as GPs will have seen this yourself in your patients. You know, you see people who have had years and years and years of mental health problems and other problems, and it isn't until you really start getting to know them and learn what's happened to them that you realise that it all started in childhood or adolescence. And a lot of what they've had to live through is just enormous, and it affects them for the rest of their lives. So I really do think that until we grasp that nettle and deal with it properly, we're not going to do much with health inequalities. Now, when I first arrived in Wales, so that was in 1995, I thought to myself, there isn't a big ethnic minority community in Wales, not like Manchester. So maybe I'm going to need to find another project, something else that I like doing. So to start with, I had a daughter of 4.5, the one who's now a GP in Chepstow, and a baby of about 6 months. So I was pretty busy trying to find a practice. So I did some locums. I found a practice in central Cardiff part-time, had my two kids to bring up, and thought, okay, now what? And then, chance somehow grabs you, doesn't it? And a GP from the other side of Cardiff, who I really hadn't heard of, I didn't know anything about her, rang me up, very Welsh lady, who said to me, I've heard about you. I want you to come and sort out my Bangladeshis. And I thought, well, who the hell is this? It was actually almost a microaggression. What do you mean, come and sort out my Bangladeshis? And I thought, first of all, I said to her, well, I'm not sure I want to come and sort out your Bangladeshis. But then I said, why don't we meet up? And I don't know how she'd heard about me, but she had. So I took along my flashcards and went to meet her. And we got on really, really well. She was actually a fantastic lady, absolutely. And she was very Welsh white, but looking after a Bangladeshi community. And she had realised that her Bangladeshi patients were falling down dead from strokes and heart attacks way earlier than they should be, and that they needed something that she wasn't providing for them. And she looked at the flashcards, which initially had been for Pakistanis, and said, this is what my patients need. This is what we should be doing. So at that point, I was still in a kind of research paradigm head. And so we applied to the Welsh Office of Research and Development, as was in those days, for funding. And of course, the first bid was rejected. So it gave us lots of feedback. So then you put it in again. The second bid was rejected. This actually happened 7 times. I was getting pretty despondent, thinking, I really don't know where we're going with this. And on the 7th occasion, I went to see them and said, look, each time you give me lovely feedback and you tell me what a good idea it is, and then I incorporate your feedback and I send it back to you and it, nothing happens. And that was when they told me the truth. And what they said to me was, well, ethnic minority health isn't a priority for Wales. And I thought, okay, fine, I'm not applying to you guys again. You know, there's no point. But, you know, nowadays, nobody would dare to say a thing like that. Nobody would dare. But that's what they said to me back in, it was by then 1997, because that was 2 years of sort of repeated applying. So what happened then was I went to the health authority and applied to them and they gave me the money. So that's really how it became, you know, service delivery. Maybe somebody up there was sort of looking down and saying, it's time to stop doing research. It's time to start delivering. And so, yes, the rest is history, as they say. So, yes, I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting. And it just shows that perseverance does eventually sort of pay off, but you've got to have somebody interested in it to start with. But I guess another aspect of this that's very relevant to yourself is the Health Foundation have kind of been released a lot of data on the fact that lower socioeconomic areas have a lower patient to doctor ratio. And so I wanted to ask you about kind of what your thoughts are on how we improve staffing and sort of recruitment for more deprived areas across the UK to sort of try and level out that inequality.
Yeah, I'd actually say it was a higher ratio, isn't it? It's more patients to doctors.
Sorry, yes, that's it.
But and you're right. It is exactly what happens now. You know, I've been working in a city, Cardiff, for close on 22, 23 years. I know I'm up in Mount Nash now, which is a different sort of deprivation. And I've seen doctors come and go. And what was happening, particularly when I was working in Bute Town in Cardiff, which is in the centre of a big Somali community, was doctors coming who really wanted to make a difference, young doctors like yourselves, coming in, wanting to do something, but the income was too poor. And they couldn't have the life that they wanted for their children, particularly, or their families, and they would leave. And, you know, and the work was harder as well, because we know that with deprivation comes more morbidity. And if you're dealing with people for whom English is a second language or a third language or a fourth language, then communication is very difficult. Getting messages across is very difficult. It is expectations are very different. Ways of life are very different. Sometimes you feel you're like ships passing in the dark, you know, not really connecting. And so people get disillusioned and leave. I think there is good evidence that we're not funding for deprivation properly, and that practices that are placed in deprived areas tend to be under-doctored, often small, often single-handed, and they don't get the funding that the practices in the leafy suburbs get, or the practices in very rural areas may get. And so it's not seen as the place to work, which is, and I think in order to change that, we need to change the funding formula. You know, you ought to be rewarded for working in a practice that's more challenging, not punished.
That's really interesting. And what you were saying before about actually just joining up health and social care, because these are societal and social issues that lead to poor healthcare. As you,
I think as doctors, we are pretty close, as GPs, we are about as close to our communities as you can get as a medical profession, aren't we? And if we don't act as their advocates, and if we don't speak up about the things we see, we're not making it up. We see it every day. Then again, I don't think that we are delivering really for our patients.
And you're right. We are advocates for the people that we work for, where we work for in our practices. And I guess that's one of the things where, and I've always held a mantra that if you maintain a longitudinal relationship with the patient population, that actually you get a lot out of that, because you start to understand that population better, and then actually can work with that population on initiatives that are going to make a difference to them. And we talked about medical education, and we talked about health disparities and working with our patients in our communities. You are about to take on quite a large role as the chair of the Royal College. Are these things that you want to bring into that role? And is there any other areas of focus that you think are going to be really important over the next 3 years?
Yeah. So there are, of course, you know, the choice is huge, isn't it, of the sort of things that you might want to deal with. I think for us as a profession at the moment, our priority has got to be about the workload, workforce issues, because unless we can do something with that, people don't have the headspace to do much else. They're just about surviving, sometimes not, as they were saying on the radio this morning with the RCGP report. And so I think the first thing is, for me, in terms of priority, is going to be what can we do to make things easier for our workforce. 6,000 GPs are not going to show up anytime soon, despite what Teresa Coffey is saying about their numbers of GPs being stable. That's just not true. They're not. They're going down. And there may be more trainees being trained every year. There are. But people are leaving faster than they're coming in. And you've got to think about it, that, you know, the sort of people who are retiring early are retiring at the height of their powers. You know, they're still young, they're still fit, they're still active, they're still able, you know, they know general practice in a way that a new incoming GP doesn't yet. And losing them is just an awful, awful waste of expertise. So we've got to find ways of retaining doctors that they will find acceptable. I don't think, you know, obviously as chair of the college, we need to continue with all our campaigning for workforce and workload issues. But I don't see evidence of many people out there wanting to help us. So my feeling is that we need to also help ourselves. We need to, as a community of GPs, help each other. And I think there are ways that we can. They may only be small ways, but every little bit counts, you know. So, for example, in Wales, because that's my experience, I suppose, so far, I've come across a few GPs who have found themselves in a real difficult situation and have worked out solutions for their particular situation, good solutions. And I think what we need to do is to identify some of these GPs. We need to give their narrative to our members. We need to applaud them and say how great they've done what they've done. But also then use them to enable other people who may be struggling to perhaps, you know, why reinvent the wheel? Just because the GP who's done, you know, who solved the problem you've got happens to live 150 miles away. Well, that's what a membership network is all about. That's the whole point of membership. So I'm hoping that we can do something along those lines for starters. I'm also quite keen that we start nurturing our allied health professionals who come and work with us now. There are lots more of them than there used to be. And I think as a college, we need to do much more to nurture and bring them on, because quite clearly we need them. And we need to work out how best to use them. You know, so I've got physios, you know, who are meant to be first contact physios in my practice, but I'm still seeing an awful lot of musculoskeletal stuff that really should have gone to them first. And so it's all about, you know, how do you triage people? How do we make sure that they see the right person at the right time in the right place? So there's quite a lot of that we need to do. And I think as a college as well, for AHPs in primary care, there's quite a lot we can do to support them, to train them, and to keep them going as well, because otherwise they're going to get as tired as we are. So that's the first thing. With that then, I am also very keen on health inequalities, as you know, and I would like to campaign about that, particularly if I can persuade people like Michael Marmot and others to work with me so that we raise awareness in the public as well as with the government on the importance of reducing social inequalities and trusting people from poorer backgrounds to enable them to build better lives for themselves. And it, you know, at the moment, you just do feel that we live in a country that is pretty low on trust. And I think, you know, that is not actually going to get us out of the hole that we're in with health inequalities. And certainly what I see happening at the moment with government just fills me with dread, because I see the poor getting poorer and the rich getting richer. So that's, those are the main things. And then the final thing is sustainable healthcare. And again, I would say that's everybody's business. It's the business of the college, but it's the business of every single one of us. And so some of what we need to do is decide, you know, what is it that each of us needs to be doing? And then what is it that the college needs to be doing as well?
That makes a lot of sense. And I think each of those areas are really important. I mean, I was just before our recording of the podcast today, I was at our primary care network meeting, and I've been, you know, supporting from an educational point of view, how do we build the infrastructure as a primary care network to support all of our staff, including all of our allied healthcare professionals, our administrative staff, our reception staff. We really need to think about how we can have real interprofessional learning and support in primary care, because we are a team, and all the pressures that we face are joint pressures.
And again, it may be a very powerful message if the college does something there as well in that arena. I'd be quite keen that we offer allied healthcare professionals some kind of association with the college. We haven't quite decided what we'd call it, whether it would be an academy or an associate membership or something like that. So that they feel included and that there is support for them as well as for GPs. I think it's just really important that we do that.
No, this sounds so exciting and so promising. I guess my question to kind of summarize is, you're very motivated, you're very passionate about change, and it's all really lovely to hear all of that, because there's a lot of noise in GP at the moment, which is quite negative, particularly amongst kind of people who, like myself, who's recently CCT'd. How do you stay positive about the future of general practice amongst sort of all the negativity at the moment?
I get my down moments as well. You know, at the end of a really busy day, you do feel like a wrung out lemon, don't you? And you go home and you really don't want to talk to anybody. I think it's because of the patients, actually. I just have such a strong feel for wanting to protect and care for patients and provide them with the very best that we can. And it makes me angry when I see patients not receiving the best possible care. And of course, that happens all the time. I think it's, and of course, one of the problems is that with the degree of workload that we have currently, it is difficult to give patients the best possible care all the time. You know, I've worked out that when I'm on call, I do Mondays in Mountain Ash, and I suppose Monday's a bad day to be on call. But, you know, when I'm on call, there will be easily 50 patient contacts. And I'm kind of not functioning that well after 28 is what I've discovered after all these years of practice. So you end up feeling really sorry for the 22 that are left. You know, that's not fair for them. You know, whereas I think that if I had more allied healthcare professionals, I'd be really happy if they saw some of those patients and I supervised them. And I saw about 25 of my own in the day. And that would be a much better day for me. So I can see light at the end of the tunnel, but it's finding your way through that tunnel to get to the light, isn't it? And I think for every doctor, every GP, it's going to be a little bit different as to what it is that gets them through the tunnel as well. I think, you know, looking back over my career, I think actually it's the patients that have provided the light most of the time. I remember as a trainee, the very first time a patient came back specifically to see me. So in my time, we did 6 months general practice first, then 2 years of hospital medicine, and then 6 months of GP. Well, it was in that first 6 months of GP, and I just started seeing patients myself. And the first lady came back to see me. I was so pleased. You know, it was just such a vote of confidence. She's very lucky. I nearly got up and hugged her, because I was so delighted. You know, it's that kind, and they have continued. You know, they give you far more sometimes than you give them I remember after my first baby coming back to work, and a little old lady came to see me, and she sat down and she said, "Now, Dr. Hawthorne, I haven't come about myself. I've come to see how you are." And I thought, oh, all right, okay, that's really sweet. But, you know, they just continually surprise you. They continue, and they always remember things you've said maybe 10 years before. I've had patients come, and I cut all my hair off in 1997. I've had patients come and say to me, "Your dad was really upset when you cut all your hair off, wasn't he?" You know, and that, I think, my goodness, how do they remember?
That's wonderful. That relationship that you can really develop with patients is the essence of general practice. I guess we're going to bring this to a close with a final question, and that's really building on what you just said, is for our next generation of GPs, those that have just entered training and are in training at the moment, and those that are coming out on the other side of training and about to embark on that first 5 years as a GP, what would be your biggest tips for their future career? And much of it will have come across already in the conversation we've had, but how would you summarize that for them?
Tips. I think be confident in yourselves. You are capable of a huge amount, and let yourselves go if you like. I think having a special project really helps, as it helped me. Sometimes change is as good as a rest. And, you know, I truly believe that a patient can do no better in the NHS than to have a good GP. I mean, I really believe that, because it's such a jungle to navigate that without a good GP helping you, you are lost. So that's why we need you. And you are infinitely as capable as we were in my time, perhaps more so, because your training's better than what I had 30, 40 years ago. So I think, you know, the future is bright, really, but we need to see it that way. The glass shouldn't be half empty. It should be half full.
The glass shouldn't be empty. It should be half full. Leave everyone with that. Thank you so much, Professor Camilla Hawthorne. I'm really excited to follow your journey as chair of the Royal College, and look forward to a more positive future in primary care.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I hope you all really enjoyed listening to that episode interviewing Camilla. It was really interesting to hear so much about what she was saying, and I think she's made some really thought-provoking comments that I'm definitely going to be reflecting on in the future. I promised that you wouldn't be hearing from me for more than a few seconds, so thank you for listening, and we will see you in the future for another wonderful episode of Somewhere in Between. Thank you. Bye.
We'd love to have you back one day as well. Perhaps, maybe a year, even 1 year on or 2 years on. Yeah. It'd be really wonderful.
Well, Holly, yeah, my hair will be even whiter, actually, and possibly all gone. Yeah. We'll see.